sacred palace, giving him absolute authority to add, delete, and change as he saw fit. After having it examined very diligently by his associate, Father Visconti, the said master of the sacred palace reviewed it again himself and licensed it. That is, having approved the book, he gave me permission but ordered to have the book printed in Rome, since, in view of the approaching summer, I wanted to go home to avoid the danger of getting sick, having been away all of May and June. We agreed that I was to return here the autumn immediately following. While I was in Florence, the plague broke out and commerce was stopped. So, seeing that I could not come to Rome, by correspondence I requested of the same master of the sacred palace permission for the book to be printed in Florence. He communicated to me that he would want to review my original manuscript and that therefore I should send it to him. Despite having used every possible care and having contacted even the highest secretaries of the Grand Duke and the directors of the postal service to try to send the said original safely, I received no assurance that this could be done, and it certainly would have been damaged, washed out, or burned, such was the strictness at the borders. I related to the same Father Master this difficulty concerning the shipping of the book, and he ordered me to have the book again very scrupulously reviewed by a person acceptable to him. The person he was pleased to designate was Father Master Giacinto Stefani, a Dominican, professor of sacred scripture at the University of Florence, preacher for the Most Serene Highnesses, and consultant to the Holy Office. The book was handed over by me to the Father Inquisitor of Florence, and by the Father Inquisitor to the said Father Giacinto Stefani. The latter returned it to the Father Inquisitor, who sent it to Signor Niccolo Dell'Antella, reviewer of books to be printed for the Most Serene Highness of Florence. The printer, named Landini, received it from this Signor Niccolo, and having negotiated with the Father Inquisitor, printed it, observing strictly every order given by the Father Master of the Sacred Palace. Question. Whether, when he sought permission from the Master of the Sacred Palace to print the said book, he revealed to the same Most Reverend Father Master the injunction previously given to him concerning the above-mentioned directive of the Holy Congregation. Answer. I did not happen to discuss that command with the Master of the Sacred Palace when I asked for the imprimatur, for I did not think it necessary to say anything, because I had no doubts about it. For I have neither maintained nor defended in that book the opinion that the earth moves and that the sun is stationary, but have rather demonstrated the opposite of the Copernican opinion and shown that the arguments of Copernicus are weak and inconclusive. This last phrase of Galileo's testimony encapsulates the agony of his position. It would be easy to accuse him of equivocating. Surely by the end of that day's questioning, he appreciated the danger he faced and may have seen good reason to hedge in self-defense. Ambassador Nicolini had even warned him to be submissive and assume whatever attitude the inquisitors seemed to want of him. But Galileo did not lie under oath. He was a Catholic who had come to believe something Catholics were forbidden to believe. Rather than break with the Church, he had tried to hold, and at the same time not to hold, this problematic hypothesis, this image of the mobile earth. His comment in the deposition recalls the duality he expressed in his reply to Ingoli, when he described how Italian scientists had come to appreciate all the nuances of Copernicanism before rejecting the theory on religious grounds. That Galileo believed in his own innocence and sincerity is clear from letters he wrote before, during, and long after the trial. The prosecutors, hearing Galileo's response, however, may well have gasped at it. Why had this case been referred to the Holy Office in the first place, if not because Urban's hired panel deemed the dialogue an overenthusiastic defense of Copernicus? The prosecutors could have questioned Galileo closely here on suspicion of deceit, but instead they said nothing. Perhaps they, too, understood the complexity of the situation, or they took him at his word, or both. With this, the deposition ended, and he was assigned a certain room in the dormitory of the officials located in the Palace of the Holy Office in lieu of prison, with the injunction not to leave it without special permission under penalty to be decided by the Holy Congregation. And he was ordered to sign below, and was sworn to silence. I, Galileo Galilei, have testified as above. Chapter 23. Vainglorious ambition, pure ignorance, and inadvertence. While Galileo awaited the outcome of this first hearing, confined to assigned rooms in the Palace of the Inquisition, a second team of three theologians cross-examined the dialogue itself. In less than a week, these consultors to the Holy Office, two of whom had served on the commission charged with reviewing the book the previous September, turned in statements of varying length and vehemence, all concurring that the book unabashedly backed Copernicus. "It is beyond question that Galileo teaches the earth's motion in writing," concluded the Jesuit panelist Melchior Incofer. "Indeed, his whole book speaks for itself, nor can one teach in any other way those of future generations and those who are absent except through writing, and he writes in Italian, certainly not to extend the hand to foreigners or other learned men, but rather to entice to that view common people in whom errors very easily take root." Not only did Incofer submit the longest of the three condemnations of the dialogue, but he also felt personally affronted by it. If Galileo had attacked some individual thinker for his inadequate arguments in favor of the stability of the earth, we might still put a favorable construction on his text, Incofer said. But as he declares war on everybody and regards as mental dwarfs all who are not Pythagorean or Copernican, it is clear enough what he has in mind. Galileo had pleaded ignorance of the more harshly worded warning. Now the consulters claimed he had violated even the most liberal interpretation of the more lenient reproof, as, in fact, he had. Although the dialogue displayed the imprimatur of the sacred palace, it reeked of heresy all the same, leaving the tribunal in a quandary the remainder of the month, trying to decide what must be done. On April 28th, a memo from Father Commissary Vincenzo Maculano da Firenzuola reached the papal vacation retreat of Castel Gandolfo, where Urban had closeted himself with nephew Francesco Cardinal Barberini. Although the Pope had instigated the trial of Galileo, Cardinal Barberini, as one of the 10 inquisitor judges in it, expended every possible effort to protect his former mentor and fellow Lynxian academician from his uncle Urban's anger. Perhaps Cardinal Barberini even suggested the very course of action that the commissary now reported having successfully accomplished. That is, he had convinced the Holy Congregation to let him deal extrajudicially with Galileo. "And not to lose time," the Father Commissary wrote to Cardinal Barberini, "I went to reason with Galileo yesterday after luncheon, and after many exchanges between us, I gained my point by the grace of God, for I made him see that he was clearly wrong, and that in his book he had gone too far." The commissary, a Dominican priest, like Father Riccardi, but trained as a military engineer, well understood the virtues of the Copernican worldview. More than that, he personally preferred to separate the construction of the universe from considerations of Holy Writ. But in that private tête-à-tête, he convinced Galileo to confess so as to let the affair end quietly, with the least loss of face all around. "The tribunal will retain its reputation and be able to use benignity with the accused," the commissary concluded his report to Cardinal Barberini. "However things turn out, Galileo will recognize the grace accorded to him, and all the other satisfactory consequences that are wished for will follow." On Saturday, the last day of April, Galileo re-entered the commissary's chambers for a second formal hearing. Over these intervening days of reflection, Galileo explained as he began the next set of his remarks recorded in the trial transcript, it had occurred to him to reread his dialogue, which he had not looked at for the past 3 years. He meant to see whether, contrary to his own beliefs, something had perchance fallen from his pen to give offense. "And owing to my not having seen it for so long," he explained, "it presented itself to me like a new writing and by another author. I freely confess that in several places it seemed to me set forth in such a form that a reader ignorant of my real purpose might have had reason to suppose that the arguments brought on the false side, and which it was my intention to confute, were so expressed as to be calculated rather to compel conviction by their cogency than to be easy of solution. Here Galileo singled out his prized theories, the argument from the sunspots and the testimony of the tides, as having been presented far too powerfully, when in fact they provided no proof. He supposed he had succumbed to the natural complacency which every man feels with regard to his own subtleties, and for showing himself to be more skillful than the generality of men in devising, even in favor of false propositions, ingenious and plausible arguments. My error, then, has been, and I confess it, one of vainglorious ambition, and of pure ignorance, and inadvertence. Dismissed, he left the room at that point, the record shows, but put his head in the door moments later, asking permission to show his good faith, as he now felt ready to do, by softening his stance on Copernicus. And there is a most favorable opportunity for this, seeing that in the work already published, the interlocutors agree to meet again after a certain time to discuss several distinct problems of nature not connected with the matter already treated. As this affords me an opportunity of adding one or two other days, I promise to resume the arguments already brought in favor of the said opinion, which is false and has been condemned, and to refute them in such an effectual way as by the blessing of God may be supplied to me. I pray, therefore, this holy tribunal to aid me in this good resolution and to enable me to put it into effect. By this suggestion, Galileo apparently hoped to save his dialogue from being banned. After hearing this heartfelt plea, the commissary returned Galileo to the Tuscan embassy out of consideration for the arthritic pains that now tormented the old man more than usual. "It is a fearful thing to have to do with the Inquisition," Ambassador Nicolini observed after welcoming Galileo once again at Villa Medici. "The poor man has come back more dead than alive." The Inquisition had not yet decided Galileo's fate by any means, and still retained the power to have him tortured or imprisoned. Nevertheless, the change of venue which Galileo immediately communicated to his friends and family bathed them all in its sweet reprieve. "Most illustrious and beloved Lord Father, the delight delivered to me by your latest loving letter was so great, and the change it wrought in me so extensive, that, taking the impact of the emotion, together with my being compelled many times to read and reread the same letter over and over to these nuns, until everyone could rejoice in the news of your triumphant successes, I was seized by a terrible headache that lasted from the 14th hour of the morning on into the night, something truly outside my usual experience. I wanted to tell you this detail not to reproach you for my small suffering, but to enable you to understand all the more how heavily your affairs weigh on my heart and fill me with concern by showing you what effects they produce in me, effects which, although generally speaking filial devotion can and should produce in all progeny, yet in me I will dare to boast that they possess greater force, as does the power that places me far ahead of most other daughters in the love and reverence I bear my dearest father, when I see clearly that he, for his part, surpasses the majority of fathers in loving me as his daughter. And that is all I have to say. I offer endless thanks to blessed God for all the favors and graces that you have been granted up till now, sire, and hope to receive in the future, since most of them issue from that merciful hand, as you most justly recognize. And even though you attribute the great share of these blessings to the merit of my prayers, this truly is little or nothing. What matters most is the sentiment with which I speak of you to His Divine Majesty, who, respecting that love, rewarding you so beneficently, answers my prayers and renders us ever more greatly obligated to Him, while we are also deeply indebted to all those people who have given you their goodwill and aid, and especially to those most preeminent nobles who are your hosts. and I did want to write to her most excellent ladyship the ambassadress, but I stay my hand, lest I vex her with my constant repetition of the same statements, these being expressions of thanks and confessions of my infinite indebtedness. You take my place, sire, and pay respects to her in my name. And truly, dearest Lord Father, the blessing that you have enjoyed from the favors and the protection of these dignitaries is so great that it suffices to assuage or even annul all the aggravations you have endured. Here is a copy I made you of a most excellent prescription against the plague that has fallen into my hands, not because I believe there is any suspicion of the malady where you are, but because this remedy also works well for all manner of ills. As to the ingredients, I am in such short supply that I must beg them for myself, on which account I cannot fill the prescription for anyone else. But you must try to procure those ingredients that perchance you may lack, sire, from the heavenly foundry, from the depths of the compassion of the Lord God, with whom I leave you. Closing with regards to you from everyone here, and in particular from Suor Arcangela and Suor Luisa, who for now, as far as her health is concerned, is getting along passing well. From San Mateo, the 7th day of May, 1633. Most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. The hard-to-fill prescription for plague preventive that Suor Maria Celeste enclosed on a separate slip of paper has not survived with this letter. Perhaps Galileo lost the recipe as a result of keeping it with him for luck or inspiration. No doubt it called for heroic measures of faith, strength, virtue, and acceptance of divine will, and none would deny the need for all of these in the days ahead. On May 10th, Galileo returned for his third deposition in the commissary's chambers to tender his formal written defense. In an earlier investigation, Galileo's statement began, "I was asked whether I had informed the Most Reverend Father Master of the Sacred Palace about the private injunction issued to me 16 years ago by order of the Holy Office not to hold, defend, or teach in any way whatever the opinion of the earth's motion and the sun's stability, and I answered no. Since I was not asked the reason why I did not inform him, I did not have the opportunity to say anything else. Now, it seems to me necessary to mention it in order to prove the absolute purity of my mind, always averse to using simulation and deceit in any of my actions." He then reviewed the events of 1616 that led to his asking Cardinal Bellarmino for the affidavit that he attached herewith as evidence. "In it, one clearly sees that I was only told not to hold or defend Copernicus's doctrine of the earth's motion and the sun's stability, but one cannot see any trace that, besides the general pronouncement applicable to all, I was given any other special order." Since Cardinal Bellarmino's private communication precisely matched the terms of the public edict of 1616, Galileo argued, and neither document contained the words, "nor teach or in any way whatever," these phrases now struck him as very new and unheard. He should not be mistrusted, he said, for having forgotten, in the course of 14 or 16 years, whether such terms had ever been uttered in his presence. And really, he had seen no need to notify the master of the sacred palace of his private injunction from Cardinal Bellarmino when it said nothing more specific than the published public one. "Given that my book was not subject to more stringent censures than those required by the decree of the index," Galileo continued, "I followed the surest and most effective way to protect it and purge it of any trace of blemish. It seems to me that this is very obvious, since I handed it over to the Supreme Inquisitor at a time when many books on the same subjects were being prohibited solely on account of the above-mentioned decree. Therefore, he hoped the most eminent and most prudent Lord Judges would concede that he had neither willfully nor knowingly disobeyed any orders given him. Indeed, those flaws that can be seen scattered in my book were not introduced through the cunning of an insincere intention, but rather through the vain ambition and satisfaction of appearing clever above and beyond the average among popular writers. After he logically ordered all the details of his affair, explained his thinking, defended the purity of his intention, and declared himself ready to make amends, Galileo pleaded for mercy. "Lastly, it remains for me to pray you to take into consideration my pitiable state of bodily indisposition, to which, at the age of 70 years, I have been reduced by 10 months of constant mental anxiety and the fatigue of a long and toilsome journey at the most inclement season, together with the loss of the greater part of the years of which, from my previous condition of health, I had the prospect." He hoped his judges would deem his decrepitude and disabilities adequate punishment for his mistakes. "Equally," he concluded, "I want them to consider my honor and reputation against the slanders of those who hate me." Over the next several weeks, while the tribunal prepared its final report to the Pope, Galileo resumed his now familiar occupation of waiting in suspense at the Tuscan embassy. Unbeknownst to him, the Grand Duke had decided to stop paying Galileo's bills there, expecting him to cover his own expenses henceforward. Ferdinando offered no explanation for this uncharacteristically ungenerous action, but he may have been moved by Urban's warnings in the Galileo affair by the April incarceration of another Florentine citizen, Mariano Alidossi, in the prisons of the Holy Office, and by the fiscal strain of paying for the ravages of the plague. Whatever the reason, Ambassador Nicolini took the news badly. "In regard to what your most illustrious lordship tells me," he wrote the Secretary of State on May 15th, "namely that His Highness does not intend to pay for Signor Galilei's expenses here beyond the first month, I can reply that I am not about to discuss this matter with him while he is my guest. I would rather assume the burden myself." The ambassador made this pledge in the full knowledge that his guest might remain under house arrest in his villa for as long as 6 months, until the trial process lumbered to its untimely resolution. Urban had returned to Rome, meanwhile, from Castel Gandolfo, and reinserted himself into the disposition of Galileo's case. He could see immediately how the inquisitors of the Holy Office fell into pro- and anti-Galileo factions. Some of them had actually attempted to read the dialogue and came away from it feeling enlightened. Others bristled at the dishonesty they perceived in Galileo's pathetic defense. All of them, however, agreed that Galileo had, at the very least, disobeyed direct orders. Even if Urban's former love for Galileo had remained untarnished instead of being tainted by betrayal, he could not now deny the obvious. The accused had defended a condemned doctrine. Nor could Urban risk any overt leniency toward Galileo, considering how the 30 years' war had raised doubts about his own guardianship of the Catholic faith. And no matter how much Urban admired the achievements of Galileo's lifetime, he had never shared his outlook on the ultimate goal of scientific discovery. Whereas Galileo believed that nature followed a divine order which revealed its hidden pattern to the persistent investigator, Urban refused to limit his omnipotent God to logical consistency. Every effect in nature, as the handiwork of God, could claim its own fantastic foundation, and each of these would necessarily exceed the limits of human imagining, even of a mind as gifted as Galileo's. Chapter 24. Faith vested in the miraculous Madonna of Impruneta. All the while Galileo sojourned in Rome, the plague regathered its strength in Florence. Suor Maria Celeste heard regularly from Signor Rondinelli of new developments and new cases reported to the local magistracy of public health. Thus, as much as she pined to have her father back at Il Gioiello, she counseled him, out of concern for his welfare, to enjoy the hospitality of his Roman hosts as long as possible. She even suggested he celebrate his eventual release from the Holy Office by making another pilgrimage to the Casa Santa in Loreto. Anything to delay his homecoming until the pestilence deserted Tuscany altogether. The walls of San Mateo continued to keep the plague at bay. Inside them, other sicknesses assailed the sisters, and all manner of non-health-related problems as well, such as the debacle of Suor Arcangela's term as provider. In this role, which fell to each of the nuns on a rotating basis, Suor Arcangela assumed charge of all outside food purchases for the convent for 1 year. As little as the nuns ate, the cost of 12 months' provisions for 30 women could easily reach 100 scudi, most of which the provider had to pay out of her own pocket, even if that pocket were empty. Some previous providers had resorted to desperate schemes to produce the requisite sums, and a few had circumvented Suor Maria Celeste to appeal directly to Galileo for emergency assistance. Now his own daughter found herself in this plight as her term of office neared its end. But just as Suor Arcangela had prevailed on others to help her shoulder the physical demands of the job owing to her frequent spells and infirmities, she deferred the worrisome financial burden as well. "I have another kindness to ask of you," Suor Maria Celeste was thus forced to address Galileo in April while he faced foes far from home. "Not for myself, but for Suor Arcangela, who, by the grace of God, 3 weeks from today, which will be the last day of this month, must leave the office of provider, in which capacity up till now she has spent 100 scudi and fallen into debt, and being obliged to leave 25 scudi in reserve for the new provider, not having anywhere else to turn, I beg your leave, with your permission, sire, to help her out with the money of yours that I hold, so that this ship can bring itself safely into port, whereas truly, without your help, it would not complete so much as half its voyage." Even after Galileo approved the release of those funds, however, Suor Maria Celeste had to approach him for more. "For Suor Arcangela, up till now I have paid close to 40, part of which I had received as a loan from Suor Luisa, and part from our allowance, of which there remains a balance of 16 scudi to draw upon for all of May. Suor Oreta spent 50 scudi. Now we are sorely pressed, and I do not know where else to turn, and since the Lord God keeps you in this life for our support, I take advantage of this blessing and seize upon it to beseech you, sire, that with God's love you free me from the worry that harasses me by lending me whatever amount of money you can until next year comes around, at which time we will recover our losses by collecting from those who must pay the expenses then, and thereby I repay you." On the back of this letter, Galileo wrote himself a reminder of something he might not easily forget. As though to aid a memory already taxed by age and stress, the note said, "Suor Maria Celeste needs money immediately." And, as usual, he saw to that need. As soon as she had settled her sister's debts with their father's help, Suor Maria Celeste learned that Suor Arcangela's next proposed position would put her in charge of the convent's wine cellar. This current year was to bring Suor Arcangela's turn as cellarer, an office that gave me much to ponder, Suor Maria Celeste told Galileo. She feared Suor Arcangela would abase the position, as she had that of provider, through inattention and perhaps abuse it, too, by usurping her authority as cellarer to overindulge in drink. "Indeed, I secured the Mother Abbess's pardon that it not be given to her by pleading various excuses, and instead she was made draper, obliging her to bleach and keep count of the tablecloths and towels in the convent." When she heard, probably from Galileo himself, how freely fine vintages flowed at the Nicolini's table, Suor Maria Celeste admonished her father not to confuse himself with wine, the beverage he had long fondly described as light held together by moisture. She feared the large quantities he'd grown accustomed to imbibing might aggravate his worsening pains. "The evil contagion still persists," she wrote on May 14th in response to Galileo's hint of how he might soon be headed homeward. but they say only a few people die of it, and the hope is that it must come to an end when the Madonna of Impruneta is carried in procession to Florence for this purpose. The Madonna of Impruneta, an icon brought to Tuscany in the 1st century, had ministered to the victims of sundry disasters. Since the Black Death in 1348, not a flood, nor a drought, nor a famine, battle, or epidemic had erupted in Florence that could not be mitigated by carrying the miraculous Madonna of Impruneta from her small church in a neighboring village down into the great cathedrals of the city. In May of 1633, Grand Duke Ferdinando called for the sacred image to retrace that long path once more to rout the resurgent plague. The magistracy of public health, however, attentive to the danger of congregation in time of contagion, issued an ordinance on May 20th to limit the number of faithful, especially women and children, who could join the procession. "As for your returning here under these prevailing conditions," Suor Maria Celeste worried in her next letter, "I can guarantee you neither resolution nor assurance on account of the contagious pestilence whose end is so urgently desired that all the faith of the city of Florence is now vested in the Most Holy Madonna, and to this effect, this morning, with great solemnity, her miraculous image was carried from Impruneta to Florence, where it is expected to stay for 3 days, and we cherish the hope that during its return journey we will enjoy the privilege of seeing her." From May 20th to 23rd, the Madonna of Impruneta passed through the streets of Florence, laid waste by the plague, and spent her nights as the guest of 3 churches which had vied for that honor. The holy image depicted Mary seated on a throne, wearing a red dress and jeweled crown, holding the baby Jesus in the folds of her blue lap robe. About her neck, real necklaces, one of pearls, the other of precious stones, embossed the flat surface of the icon, the whole of which stood inside a red frame, rounded at the top like an archway. 8 men carried the poles holding the ornate canopy above the Madonna, and at least another 12 shared the weight and the glory of bearing the table on which her venerated form rested. When leaving Florence, Suor Maria Celeste recounted, "The image of the Most Holy Madonna of Impruneta came into our church, a grace truly worthy of note, because she was passing from the Piano dei Giulari, so that she had to come this way, going back along the whole length of that road you know so well, sire, and weighing in excess of 700 libre, about 1/4 ton, with the tabernacle and adornments. Its size, rendering it unable to fit through our gate, it became necessary to break the wall of the courtyard and raise the doorway of the church, which we accomplished with great readiness for such an occasion." In the weeks following the Madonna's visit, the death toll from the plague alternately dipped and climbed, so that the full extent of the miracle she had wrought did not become clear until September 17, 1633, when the authorities declared Florence officially free of contamination. In early June, however, as the day of Galileo's judgment approached, Suor Maria Celeste still heard word of 7 or 8 plague fatalities every day. And Signor Rondinelli warned her that the open country around Rome would be closed to travelers for the summer months as a further precaution to preserve the safety of the Holy City. If Galileo were not allowed to leave the embassy in the very near future, he would be stuck there at least until autumn. In mid-June, she again cautioned her father against hasty departure, urging him to stay put, away from "these perils, which in spite of everything continue and may even be multiplying. And in consequence, an order has come to our monastery, and to others as well, from the commissioners of health, stating that for a period of 40 days we must, 2 nuns at a time, pray continuously day and night, beseeching His Divine Majesty for freedom from this scourge. We received alms of 25 scudi from the commissioners for our prayers, and today marks the 4th day since our vigil began." All the worry Suor Maria Celeste expended over the plague danger facing her father was unoccasioned, however, since the Inquisition had no intention of releasing Galileo any time soon. On June 16th, Pope Urban VIII presided over a meeting of the Cardinal Inquisitors. Urban had absorbed the official report, summarizing the Galileo affair from the first accusations against the philosopher in 1615 through the publication of his book, up to his recent defense and plea for mercy. Now His Holiness demanded that Galileo be interrogated on intent, to determine, technically by torture if necessary, his true purpose in writing the dialogue. The book itself could not escape censure in any case, the pontiff averred, and would assuredly be prohibited. As for Galileo, he would have to serve a prison term and perform penance. His public humiliation would warn all Christendom of the folly of disobeying orders and gainsaying Holy Scripture dictated by the mouth of God. To give you news of everything about the house, Sor Maria Celeste wrote on June 18th, unaware of the awful turn of events in Rome, I will start from the dovecote, where since Lent the pigeons have been brooding. The first pair to be hatched were devoured one night by some animal, and the pigeon who had been setting them was found draped over a rafter, half-eaten and completely eviscerated, on which account La Piera assumed the culprit to be some bird of prey. And the other frightened pigeons would not go back there, but as La Piera kept on feeding them, they have since recovered themselves, and now two more are brooding. The orange trees bore few flowers, which La Piera pressed, and she tells me she has drawn a whole pitcherful of orange water. The capers, when the time comes, will be sufficient to suit you, sire. The lettuce that was sown, according to your instructions, never came up, and in its place La Piera planted beans that she claims are quite beautiful, and coming lastly to the chickpeas, it seems the hare will win the largest share, he having already begun to make off with them. The broad beans are set out to dry, and their stalks fed for breakfast to the little mule, who has become so haughty that she refuses to carry anyone, and has several times thrown poor Geppo so as to make him turn somersaults, but gently, since he was not hurt. Cecilia's brother Ascanio once asked to ride her out, though when he approached the gate to Prato he decided to turn back, never having gained the upper hand over the obstinate creature to make her proceed, as she perhaps disdains to be ridden by others, finding herself without her true master. On the morning of June 21st, the little mule's true master ushered into the chambers of the Commissary General for the fourth and final time, Galileo endured his examination on intent by Father Maculano. Question. Whether he had anything to say? Answer. I have nothing to say. Question. Whether he holds or has held, and for how long, that the sun is the center of the world, and the earth is not the center of the world, but moves also with diurnal motion. Answer. A long time ago, that is, before the decision of the Holy Congregation of the Index, and before I was issued that injunction, I was undecided and regarded the two opinions, those of Ptolemy and Copernicus, as disputable, because either the one or the other could be true in nature. But after the said decision, assured by the prudence of the authorities, all my uncertainty stopped, and I held, as I still hold, as most true and indisputable, Ptolemy's opinion, namely, the stability of the earth and the motion of the sun. Having been told that he is presumed to have held the said opinion after that time, from the manner and procedure in which the said opinion is discussed and defended in the book he published, indeed, from the very fact that he wrote and published the said book, he was asked, therefore, to freely tell the truth whether he holds or has held that opinion. Answer. In regard to my writing of the published dialogue, I did not do so because I held the Copernican doctrine to be true. Instead, deeming only to confer a common benefit, I set forth the physical and astronomical reasons that can be advanced for each side. I tried to show that neither set of arguments has the force of conclusive demonstration in favor of the one opinion or the other, and that therefore to proceed with certainty one had to resort to the decisions of higher teaching, as one can see in many passages in the dialogue. So for my part, I conclude that I do not hold, and after the determination of the authorities, I have not held the condemned opinion. having been told that from the book itself and the reasons advanced for the affirmative side, namely that the earth moves and the sun is motionless, he is presumed, as it was stated, to hold Copernicus's opinion, or at least to have held it at the time. Therefore he was told that unless he decided to proffer the truth, one would have recourse to the remedies of the law and to appropriate steps against him. Answer. I do not hold this opinion of Copernicus, and I have not held it after being ordered by injunction to abandon it. For the rest, I am here in your hands. Do with me what you please. And he was told to tell the truth, otherwise one would have recourse to torture. Answer, I am here to obey. But I have not held this opinion after the determination was made, as I said. Chapter 25. Judgment passed on your book and your person. Despite the hopes of Galileo and his supporters that his affair would end quietly in a private admonition, with his dialogue merely suspended until corrected, as Copernicus's book had been, the sentence pronounced on Wednesday, June 22nd, publicly convicted him of heinous crimes. The cardinal inquisitors and their witnesses gathered that morning in the Dominican convent adjoining the Church of Santa Maria Sopra Minerva in the center of the city, where they typically held their weekly meetings. Up a spiral staircase, into a room with a frescoed ceiling, Galileo followed his judges to hear the results of their deliberations. "We say, pronounce, sentence, and declare, that you, Galileo, by reason of the matters which have been detailed in the trial and which you have confessed already, have rendered yourself in the judgment of this holy office vehemently suspected of heresy, namely of having held and believed the doctrine which is false and contrary to the sacred and divine scriptures, that the sun is the center of the world and does not move from east to west, and that the earth moves and is not the center of the world, and that one may hold and defend as probable an opinion after it has been declared and defined contrary to Holy Scripture. Consequently, you have incurred all the censures and penalties enjoined and promulgated by the sacred canons and all particular and general laws against such delinquents. We are willing to absolve you from them, provided that first, with a sincere heart and unfeigned faith, in our presence, you abjure, curse, and detest the said errors and heresies, and every other error and heresy contrary to the Catholic and Apostolic Church in the manner and form we will prescribe to you. Furthermore, so that this grievous and pernicious error and transgression of yours may not go altogether unpunished, and so that you will be more cautious in future and an example for others to abstain from delinquencies of this sort, we order that the book Dialogue of Galileo Galilei be prohibited by public edict. We condemn you to formal imprisonment in this holy office at our pleasure. As a salutary penance, we impose on you to recite the 7 penitential psalms once a week for the next 3 years. And we reserve to ourselves the power of moderating, commuting, or taking off the whole or part of the said penalties and penances. This we say, pronounce, sentence, declare, order, and reserve by this or any other better manner or form that we reasonably can or shall think of. So we, the undersigned cardinals, pronounce." Even though the opinion of Copernicus had been rescued from the shame of heresy in 1616, Galileo, for his exposition of Copernicus, now stood vehemently suspected of heresy himself. Only 7 of the 10 inquisitors affixed their signatures to the sentence. Francesco Cardinal Barberini, the strongest advocate for clemency among them, pointedly stayed away from the session and declined to sign. Also absent was Gaspare Cardinal Borgia, who perhaps used this occasion to reproach Pope Urban further for his pro-French behavior in the 30 Years' War, or to thank Galileo for the suggestions he once offered the Spanish government on solving the longitude problem by observing the moons of Jupiter. Laudivio Cardinal Zacchia, one of the first cardinals to whom Grand Duke Ferdinando wrote in defense of Galileo, also withheld his signature for reasons equally unknown. Perhaps he was ill that day and could not attend. The Holy Tribunal presented Galileo its draft text of an abjuration for him to speak aloud. But in reading it first silently to himself, he discovered two clauses so abhorrent that he could not be convinced even under the circumstances to concede them. One suggested he had lapsed in his behavior as a good Catholic. The other, that he had acted deceitfully in obtaining the imprimatur for the dialogue. He had done nothing of the kind, he said, and the officials granted his request to strike these references from the script. Dressed in the white robe of the penitent, the accused then knelt and abjured as ordered. "I, Galileo, son of the late Vincenzo Galilei, Florentine, aged 70 years, arraigned personally before this tribunal, and kneeling before you, most eminent and reverend Lord Cardinals, inquisitors general against heretical depravity throughout the Christian Commonwealth, having before my eyes and touching with my hands the Holy Gospels, swear that I have always believed, I believe now, and with God's help I will in future believe all that is held, preached, and taught by the Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. But whereas, after having been admonished by this holy office entirely to abandon the false opinion that the sun is the center of the world and immovable, and that the earth is not the center of the same, and that it moves, and that I must not hold, defend, nor teach in any manner whatever, either orally or in writing, the said false doctrine, and after it had been notified to me that the said doctrine was contrary to holy writ, I wrote and caused to be printed a book in which I treat of the already condemned doctrine and adduce arguments of much efficacy in its favor without arriving at any solution. I have been judged vehemently suspected of heresy, that is, of having held and believed that the sun is the center of the world and immovable, and that the earth is not the center and moves. Therefore, wishing to remove from the minds of your eminences, and of all faithful Christians, this vehement suspicion justly conceived against me, I abjure with a sincere heart and unfeigned faith. I curse and detest the said errors and heresies, and generally all and every error and sect contrary to the Holy Catholic Church. And I swear that for the future I will never again say nor assert in speaking or writing such things as may bring upon me similar suspicion. And if I know any heretic or person suspected of heresy, I will denounce him to this holy office, or to the inquisitor or ordinary of the place where I may be. I also swear and promise to adopt and observe entirely all the penances which have been or may be imposed on me by this holy office. And if I contravene any of these said promises, protests, or oaths, which God forbid, I submit myself to all the pains and penalties imposed and promulgated by the sacred canons and other decrees, general and particular, against such offenders. So help me God, and these his holy gospels, which I touch with my own hands. I, the said Galileo Galilei, have abjured, sworn, promised and bound myself as above, and in witness of the truth with my own hand have subscribed the present document of my abjuration, and have recited it word by word in Rome, at the convent of the Minerva, this 22nd day of June, 1633. I, Galileo Galilei, have abjured as above, with my own hand. It is often said that as Galileo rose from his knees, he muttered under his breath, "Eppur si muove," but still it moves. Or he shouted out these words, looking toward the sky and stamping his foot. Either way, for Galileo to voice such undaunted conviction in this hostile encounter would have been beyond foolhardy, not to mention that the comment suggests a defiant feistiness beyond his means to muster then and there. He may have said it weeks or months later, in front of other witnesses, but not on that day. He sustained his condemnation in the convent of the Minerva as a breach of the promises made him in exchange for his cooperation. For he believed in his own innocence. He had admitted committing a crime only because his confession had been part of a deal. Within days, Cardinal Barberini successfully softened Galileo's sentence by changing the place of his imprisonment from the dungeons of the Holy Office to the Tuscan embassy in Rome. Then Ambassador Nicolini entreated Pope Urban to pardon Galileo and send him home to Florence. Galileo, he explained to bolster his plea, had agreed to take in his widowed sister-in-law, who was even now preparing to depart from Germany along with her 8 children and had nowhere else to turn. Urban rejected the idea of the pardon, but he consented to let Galileo leave Rome at last. With Cardinal Barberini's intervention, Galileo was consigned for the first 5 months of his prison term to the custody of the Archbishop of Siena, who had already offered to send his personal litter to ensure safe, speedy conveyance to his palace. The dialogue duly appeared on the next published index of prohibited books in 1664, where it would remain for nearly 200 years. Most illustrious and beloved Lord Father, just as suddenly and unexpectedly as word of your new torment reached me, sire, so intensely did it pierce my soul with pain to hear the judgment that has finally been passed, denouncing your person as harshly as your book. I learned all this by importuning Signor Geri, because, not having any letters from you this week, I could not calm myself as though I already knew all that had happened. My dearest Lord Father, now is the time to avail yourself more than ever of that prudence which the Lord God has granted you, bearing these blows with that strength of spirit which your religion, your profession, and your age require. And since you, by virtue of your vast experience, can lay claim to full cognizance of the fallacy and instability of everything in this miserable world, you must not make too much of these storms, but rather take hope that they will soon subside and transform themselves from troubles into as many satisfactions. In saying all that I am speaking, what my own desires dictate, and also what seems a promise of leniency demonstrated toward you, sire, by His Holiness, who has destined for your prison a place so delightful, whereby it appears we may anticipate another commutation of your sentence, conforming even more closely with all your and our wishes. May it please God to see things turn out that way, if it be for the best. Meanwhile, I pray you not to leave me without the consolation of your letters, giving me reports of your condition, physically and especially spiritually. Though I conclude my writing here, I never cease to accompany you with my thoughts and prayers, calling on His Divine Majesty to grant you true peace and consolation. From San Mateo, the 2nd day of July, 1633. Most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. Galileo's humiliation spread outward from Rome as fast as messengers could carry the news. At the Pope's command and with fanfare, the text of Galileo's mortifying sentence was posted and read aloud by inquisitors from Padua to Bologna, from Milan to Mantua, from Florence to Naples to Venice, and on to France, Flanders, and Switzerland, alerting the professors of philosophy and mathematics at each locale of the outcome of Galileo's affair. In Florence, in particular, instructions called for the condemnation to occasion a plenary session of the Florentine Inquisition, to which as many mathematicians as possible should be invited. In the summer of 1633, spurred by these events, a lively black market trade sprang up around the banned dialogue. The price of the book, which had originally sold for 0.5 scudo, rose to 4 and then to 6 scudi as priests and professors across the country purchased copies to keep the inquisitors from cornering the market. A Paduan friend of Galileo's wrote to tell him how the well-known university philosopher Fortunio Licetti had actually surrendered his copy to the authorities, as though this were a most singular aberrant act, and no one else who owned the dialogue could bear to part with it. As the book grew in esteem among Galileo's cohorts, it also gained new converts. Sometime later that July or August, a messenger smuggled a copy of the dialogue across the Alps with the help of clandestine agents to Strasbourg, where the Austrian historian Matthias Berniger began to prepare a Latin translation that would be ready for general distribution throughout Europe by 1635. In 1661, an English version of the dialogue appeared, translated by Thomas Salisbury. The prohibition of the book by the Index endured for a long time, but not with a long arm outside Italy. In 1744, publishers in Padua gained permission to include the dialogue in a posthumous collection of Galileo's works by inserting appropriate qualifying remarks and disclaimers in the text. But this concession did not lead to any rapid relaxation of the ruling against the dialogue, which remained officially prohibited. On April 16, 1757, when the Congregation of the Index withdrew its general objections against books teaching the Copernican doctrine, it specifically cited the dialogue as a still forbidden title. The dialogue, in fact, stayed banned for another 65 years until 1822, when the Congregation of the Holy Office decided to allow publication of books on modern astronomy expounding the movement of the earth. No new index, however, was issued at the time to reflect this change in attitude. Thus, the 1835 edition became the first index in almost two centuries to drop the listing of the Dialogue of Galileo Galilei. Chapter 26. Not knowing how to refuse him the keys. In framing Galileo's trial as a simplistic case of science versus religion, anti-Catholic critics have claimed that the Church opposed a scientific theory on biblical grounds and that the outcome mocked the infallibility of the Pope. Technically, however, the anti-Copernican edict of 1616 was issued by the Congregation of the Index, not by the Church. Similarly, in 1633, Galileo was tried and sentenced by the Holy Office of the Inquisition, not by the Church. And even though Pope Paul V approved the Edict of 1616, just as Pope Urban VIII condoned Galileo's conviction, neither pontiff invoked papal infallibility in either situation. The freedom from error that belongs to the Pope as his special privilege applies only when he speaks as shepherd of the Church to issue formal proclamations on matters of faith and morals. What's more, the right of infallibility was never formally defined in Galileo's time, but issued two centuries later from Vatican Council I, held in 1869 to 1870. Although Urban personally believed in his own power enough to boast that the sentence of one living pope, namely Urban himself, outweighed all the decrees of 100 dead ones, he refrained from claiming infallibility in the Galileo case. French philosopher René Descartes, who followed Galileo's trial from his home in Holland, understood these distinctions. Thus, Descartes could comment hopefully to a colleague, "As I do not see that this censure has been confirmed, either by a council or by the Pope, but proceeds solely from a committee of cardinals, it may still happen to the Copernican theory as it did to that of the Antipodes, the 8th century censured notion of a sub-earth earth with human inhabitants, which was once condemned in the same way." Nevertheless, Descartes, a product of his Jesuit education and a devout Catholic throughout his life, withheld from publishing the book he himself had just completed, Le Monde, which espoused Copernicus's view of the universe. Numerous churchmen, however, including highly placed clerics such as Ascanio Piccolomini, the Archbishop of Siena, had endorsed Galileo's dialogue from their initial reading of it and continued to consider the author their friend. "It seems exceeding strange to me," Archbishop Piccolomini had written to Galileo when the outcry over the dialogue first arose, "that such a recent and precise approbation should be opposed by the passions of some people who might find fault only in what they conceive of the book, for the work itself ought to appease the most timid conscience. On the other hand, I will say you deserve this and worse, for you have been disarming by steps those who have control of the sciences, and they have nothing left but to run back to holy ground." Archbishop Piccolomini, capping a long line of scholars from a distinguished family that produced two popes, had himself studied mathematics and been Galileo's admirer for many years. Now, in the aftermath of the trial, Piccolomini assumed custody of Galileo, who left the Tuscan embassy in Rome on July 6th and arrived at the archiepiscopal palace, immediately adjacent to the magnificent domed cathedral of Siena, 3 days later on July 9th. If Galileo looked more dead than alive, as Ambassador Nicolini had described him when he returned from his April questioning by the Holy Office, How must he have appeared at Siena in July, after these many more weeks and traumas? The injustice of the sentence tormented him so that he did not sleep for several nights, but could be heard crying out, babbling and rambling in distraction. The archbishop feared for his safety to the point where he considered binding Galileo's arms to keep him from accidentally injuring himself in bed. Piccolomini determined to restore the man's broken spirit and return his thoughts to scientific pursuits. The fact that Galileo was able to rise from the ashes of his condemnation by the Inquisition to complete another book project, and for this last work to prove his greatest original contribution, is due in large measure to Piccolomini's solicitous kindness. A French visitor to Siena in 1633, the poet Saint-Amand, reported finding the archbishop and Galileo together among the rich tapestries and furnishings that filled the guest apartment at the palace, engaging each other in discussion of a mechanical theory, which lay partially written on pages spread all around them. Most illustrious and beloved Lord Father, that the letter you wrote me from Siena, where you say you find yourself in good health, brought me the greatest pleasure, and the same to Suor Arcangela, is needless for me to weary myself in convincing you, sire, since you will well know how to fathom what I could not begin to express. But I should love to describe to you the show of jubilation and merriment that these mothers and sisters made upon learning of your happy return, for it was truly extraordinary. Since the mother abbess, with many others, hearing the news, ran to me with open arms and crying with tenderness and happiness. Truly I am bound as a slave to all of them, for having understood from this display how much love they feel for you, sire, and for us. Hearing furthermore that you are staying in the home of a host as kind and courteous as Monsignor Archbishop multiplies the pleasure and satisfaction despite the potential prejudicial effect this may have on our own interests, because it could well prove to be the case that his extremely enjoyable conversation may engage and detain you much longer than we would like. However, since here for now the suspicions of contagion continue, I commend your remaining there, and awaiting, as you say you wish to do, the safety assurance from your closest friends, who, if not with greater love, at least with more certainty than we possess, will be able to apprise you of the facts. But meanwhile, I should judge that it would be wise to draw a profit from the wine in your cellar, at least one cask's worth, because although for now it is keeping well, I fear this heat may precipitate some peculiar effect. And already the cask that you had tapped before you left, sire, from which the housemaid and the servant drink, has begun to spoil. You will need to give orders as to what you want done, because I have so little knowledge of this business. But I am coming to the conclusion that since you produced enough to last the entire year, and as you have been away for 6 of those months, you will still have plenty left, even if you should return in a few days. Leaving this aside, however, and turning to that which concerns me more, I am longing to know in what manner your affair was terminated to the satisfaction of both you and your adversaries, as you intimated in the next-to-last letter you wrote me from Rome. Tell me the details at your convenience, and only after you have rested, because I can be patient a while longer, awaiting enlightenment on this contradiction. Signor Geri was here one morning, during the time we suspected you to be in the greatest danger, sire, and he and Signor Adjunti went to your house and did what had to be done, which you later told me was your idea, seeming to me at the time well-conceived and essential, to avoid some worse disaster that might yet befall you, wherefore I knew not how to refuse him the keys and the freedom to do what he intended, seeing his tremendous zeal in serving your interests, sire. Last Saturday I wrote to her ladyship the ambassadress with all the great love that I felt, and if I receive an answer I shall share it with you. I close here, because sleep assails me now at the 3rd hour of the night, on which account you will excuse me, sire, in the event I have said anything inappropriate. I return to you doubled all the regards you offered to those named in your letter, and especially La Piera and Jeppo, who are thoroughly cheered by your return. And I pray blessed God to give you his holy grace. From San Mateo, the 3rd day of July, 1633. Most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. The deed that Signor Geri Bucchineri accomplished in Galileo's absence, with the help of their young mutual friend Niccolò Adjunti, head of mathematics at Pisa, involved the destruction of potentially incriminating evidence. fearing that representatives of the Inquisition might requisition Galileo's papers, his supporters took the prudent path of editing what could be found on his property. Even though Signor Geri arrived at the convent in advance of Galileo's letter announcing his mission, Suor Maria Celeste surrendered her keys to him without hesitation. Geri served as a trusted link to her father throughout this period, and no one but her father could have informed him that she held the needed keys in safekeeping. These must have opened a certain closet or cabinet in Galileo's study, for surely Geri could have obtained keys to the